Chapter 9. Fermenting Beers and Other Grain-Based Alcoholic Beverages. Beer is the first thing many people think of when they hear the word fermentation, as I have learned, having had brief conversations on this broad topic with many people. I too love the beer they are usually thinking of, brewed from malted barley with hops. However, I define beer much more broadly than the famous 1516 Bavarian beer purity law, Reinheitsgebot, and other laws that have codified those or some others as beer's sole legitimate ingredients. I define beer as a fermented alcoholic beverage in which the alcohol derives primarily from the complex carbohydrates of grains, or starchy tubers. As we have just seen in the last chapter, spontaneous fermentations of grains generally result in sour rather than alcoholic products. Whereas honey, sugar, fruit juices, plant saps, and other simple sugars ferment into alcohol spontaneously, grains require conversion of complex carbohydrates into simple sugars via enzyme activity before they can ferment into any significant amount of alcohol. The enzymes that do this in the Western beer-making tradition come from malting grains, more commonly known as sprouting or germinating. The embryo restarts its biochemical machinery and produces various enzymes, including some that break down the barley cell walls and others that break down the starch and proteins inside the cells of the food storage tissue, the endosperm, explains Harold McGee. These enzymes then diffuse through the embryo into the endosperm, where they work together to dissolve away the cell walls, penetrate the cells, and digest some of the starch granules and protein bodies inside. Malting is not the only method of enzymatic transformation for fermenting grains and starchy tubers into alcohol. The enzymes most often used in the Asian traditions of making alcohol from rice, millet, and other grains come from molds. In parts of South America, Africa, and Asia, a third source of enzymes used to break down grains and starchy tubers for making alcohol, possibly the most ancient, is the use of human saliva by simply chewing them. Each of these methods is explored ahead. Though making alcohol from grain requires more extensive processing than making it from grapes or other sources of sugars, grains offer certain inherent advantages, primarily related to availability of raw materials. McGee summarizes that grains are quicker and easier to grow than the grapevine, much more productive in a given acreage, can be stored for many months before being fermented, and can be made into beer any day of the year, not just at harvest time. There are an intimidating number of steps involved in making beer from raw grain. Virtually all contemporary brewers, homebrew hobbyists, craft and microbrewers, regional brands, and industry giants alike rely upon already prepared malt or malt extracts. There is a section ahead covering malting barley for those like myself who are obsessed with directly experiencing all these different transformational processes. Most of the beer brewing that I have done has been the full process from grain to beer. But with an eye toward simplicity and technical ease, I have experimented more in the realm of thicker, starchier, more nutritive, opaque beers than with refined styles, filtered and clarified, with most of the starch removed. The sections that follow focus on some opaque beers that I've learned to make. I have not experienced most of these in their indigenous contexts. The processes I followed were experimental, based upon written information, sometimes conflicting, varying in details. The processes I describe are my interpretations and improvisations. Wild yeast beers. Another quirk of my beer brewing practice is that it has mostly relied upon wild fermentation. The ingredients for wine, cider, and mead, fruit, honey, and other simple sugars, are always populated by fermenting yeasts, provided that they are raw and not cooked or heated in their processing, as with sugar. In contrast, beer is almost always cooked before it is fermented, so the grains in the mash are not a reliable source for populating it with fermenting microbes. Far more than a haphazard process, spontaneous fermentation requires a source of wild yeast and favorable circumstances, writes Jeff Sparrow, author of the book Wild Brews, Beer Beyond the Influence of Brewer's Yeast. Sometimes mixed cultures are obtained from the air, as in the famed Belgian wild yeast brews, or from raw malted grains or other plant material, or starters from a previous batch, including, in some cases, simply residue left in a vessel or on a ritual stirring branch. Stephen Harrod Buhner, author of Sacred and Herbal Healing Beers, encourages his readers to call upon spirits as well as use practical methods to help initiate wild yeast fermentation. When the wort, pre-fermented barley malt brew filtered and ready to ferment, is ready, you might leave it out, uncovered, in a container with a wide opening. Then sit near it and begin to talk with the spirit of the yeast, to call on the Brygjemen or Kveik to come, and see what it is like. To do so means reconnecting to the ancient tradition of fermentation, to connect to the thousands of wise women and wise men standing over their brewing vessels in small villages around the world, calling on the spirits of fermentation to come to the wort and kindle the fire in it. Once you have brought a wild yeast to live at your home, place a carved stick in the fermenter and allow the yeast to fall deeply within its carvings. When the beer is finished, take the stick out and hang it up to dry somewhere out of the way. At your next fermentation, take it down and place it in the fermenter, and call on it once again to awaken to life. As I was writing this book, I visited Brussels, the capital of Belgium, and Yvan de Betz, my brewer friend there, sent me to see the brewery Cantillon, a small-scale producer of the region's distinctive wild-fermented lambic beer, offering tours and public brewing sessions. There, I met the owner and master brewer, Jean Van Roy, who is continuing a family enterprise going back four generations. When his great-grandfather founded the brewery in 1900, there were hundreds of breweries in Brussels. Today, Cantillon is the last traditional brewery left in the city. The beer brewed at Cantillon is fermented by wild yeast and bacteria, spontaneously drawn to it via the air. Cool weather favors the microbial mix that produces the best beer, so the brewery brews only in cool seasons. After brewing, the hot wort is cooled in a big open tank called a cool ship, with a broad surface area, something like a shallow copper wading pool, under vented rafters. As the wort cools to temperatures yeasts and lactic acid bacteria can tolerate, it becomes populated by these organisms present in the environment. According to legend, such fermentation is only possible in the region of Brussels and more specifically in the Seine Valley, the river which flows through Brussels, states Cantillon's brochure. One explanation I've encountered for the quality of the Seine Valley yeast is the historic concentration of cherry trees and other fruit bearers there, which, unfortunately, has declined sharply over the past century. When I asked Jean whether the concentration of yeasts in the valley meant he could relocate his brewery to any building there, he said definitely not. He was emphatic that he thought the characteristic wild organisms had become established in the building itself. Considering the loss of the Schaerbeek cherry orchard surrounding Brussels as a continuing source of fresh wild yeast, the buildings now play a greater role than ever before, notes Jeff Sparrow. In the past, all beer relied upon wild yeasts. There is at least one brewery starting up in the United States brewing beer using local wild yeasts called Mystic Brewery in Boston. "We aren't afraid of no stinking microbes, quite literally," states the Mystic website. "Our way is to brew new beers in the old tradition. Our way is to make living beer." Wild yeast beers tend to have a sour edge to them. At one time, all beers exhibited some level of tart, sour, acidic character, writes Jeff Sparrow. Modern brewing methods helped to virtually eliminate these characteristics in beer. Beer blogger Michael Agnew enthuses that sour beers are among the most mind-blowing, uniquely complex, and delicious beers in the world. These are beers that will forever shatter your notions of what beer is. Yet, we all have preconceived notions. I think the most important thing for brewers to prepare is their own palate, offers fermentation experimentalist Luke Regalbuto. Wild fermented beers are not going to taste like you expect if you drink commercial beer in the U.S. Wild fermented beverages are often very sour and different. They take a little getting used to. When we traveled to Europe, I was very surprised that the traditional wild fermented brews and ciders were very sour, so much so that I realized that I had tossed wild fermented brews thinking they had gone to vinegar when they were actually still good. Our expectations are shaped by experience, and just a few isolated species of yeast are used in almost all brewing. The use of different microorganisms is one of the least studied and, currently, least practiced fields of brewing, states brewmaster Peter Buchert of Colorado's New Belgium Brewing Company. There are not one or two varieties of beer-souring microorganisms, but dozens and sometimes hundreds of different strains, according to Jeff Sparrow. Scientists have isolated more than 200 different organisms at work in the fermentation of alambic. For most of the beers described in this chapter, rather than relying upon the air as the source of yeast exposure, we will introduce raw malted grains. This is an easy method used in some indigenous brewing traditions. But try the air, especially if you are near lots of fruit trees. You could also try using fresh organic fruit as a source of yeasts, or the foam from another active yeasty ferment, or try your hand at catching yeast from the air by frequently stirring. Keep using the same tool without washing it, or skip all this wild experimentation and add a packet of yeast. Tezguino. Tezguino is a traditional beer of some of Mexico's indigenous peoples, made from malted corn. Like many traditional beers, it is thick and starchy enough to be a nutritive food as well an intoxicant. Tezguino is delicious and easy to make. In a nutshell, sprout dry field corn until sprouts reach about an inch, 2.5 centimeters, in length, roughly 5 days to a week, then crush it into a fine paste. Boil this paste in water for 8 to 12 hours, or as long as 24 hours, adding more water as necessary. The sprouted corn paste smells and tastes grassy, which is, after all, what corn and all grains are, grass. The long cooking caramelizes sugars, transforming that grassiness into a sweeter, deeper, and more distinctive corn-flavored sweet syrup. Then dilute this syrup with more water, cool, and ferment into Tezguino in just a few days. The process is described in greater detail in the following sections. For the Tarahumara people of northern Mexico, Tezguino is of primary functional importance in the social organization and culture, according to anthropologist John G. Kennedy. Tezguino drinking events, known as Tezguinada, are the basic social activity of the people and are frequent ceremonial events. Tezguinada also play an important economic role. Often they are work parties in which Tezguino serves as the reward for helping. The procedure, when one needs to accomplish a major task such as weeding, harvesting, cutting fodder, spreading fertilizer, fence making, or house building, is to make an appropriate amount of Tezguino, and then to invite men from the surrounding ranchos to come to work and drink. Tezguino is considered the pay one receives for the work and is a mandatory ingredient in the situation, though basic motivations are the reciprocal bonds, obligation, and privilege which hold between the men in the vicinity. When the inviter makes his rounds to the various households, he says, "Would you like to drink a little Tezguino tomorrow?" He feels it unnecessary to first mention that work will be a part of the program and stresses the social aspect of the Tezguinada to follow. A man may choose to perform any task alone or to make Tezguino, but the latter method is much preferred because of the time and effort saved and because of the euphoria of group participation which is so lacking in the relative solitude of everyday life. This group camaraderie is, of course, considerably enhanced by the effects of the alcohol. The importance of the Tezguinada extends far beyond labor. It is the religious group, the economic group, the entertainment group, the group at which disputes are settled, marriages arranged, and deals completed. Ethnobotanist William Litzinger described the Tarahumara methods of Tezguino preparation in some detail in his 1983 PhD dissertation. "Sprouting the kernels is the longest part of the process," writes Litzinger, describing a range of containers used to sprout the corn while protecting it from light, so it does not develop bitter chlorophyll. Many kinds of containers are used for sprouting maize kernels, including wooden boxes and tin cans. Earthen pits are also used. They are dug in a sunny, protected spot near the house. The pits are lined with grass leaves or other green foliage and covered with a layer of pine needles. During the winter months, the kernels are sprouted in containers placed inside the house, close to the cooking fire where a good, even level of heat is maintained. I use a gallon jar, but draped with a cloth to shield it from light. 1 pound or 500 grams of corn will yield about 1/2 gallon or 2 liters of Tezguino. Soak corn kernels for about 24 hours, then drain well. Continue to rinse several times a day and drain well each time for up to about a week until the sprouts reach a length of about an inch or 2.5 centimeters. Often people do not understand what dry whole field corn is or where to find it. Dry field corn is not fresh sweet corn. It is typically starchier, drier varieties of corn grown for feed or milling, dried, with kernels removed from the cob. It is not popcorn varieties. Often you can find it in natural foods stores or buying clubs. These days, with genetically modified corn so commonly grown, I would definitely recommend seeking out organic corn. And if you want to try growing corn, try Dent varieties. You can also buy already malted corn, called yora in Spanish, available in many Mexican markets. Next, grind and pound malted corn into a paste. I have made tesguino using a mortar and pestle, and using a food processor, both with fine results. Then cook the sprouted corn paste in water, the longer the better. Maintain a low flame and stir frequently. Written directions I've found recommend cooking everywhere from 8 to 24 hours. I've averaged around 12. Stir periodically and add water as necessary. As the hours pass, the corn brew smells better and better. Once you decide it is cooked long enough, strain out the solid chunks, cool, and culture. The tarahumara typically introduce yeast to the tesguino by simply placing it into an olla, pot, dedicated to the purpose. The tarahumara never wash or rinse out their fermentation ollas, writes Litzinger. Due to this, the interior of the ollas become encrusted with a thick organic layer, which has been found to contain Saccharomyces cerevisiae. According to W.C. Bennett and R.M. Zing, who published a book on the tribe in 1935, the tarahumara describe the ollas they use as having learned to boil well. If you do not yet possess a vessel dedicated to tesguino, you will have to culture it in some other way. You could simply add a packet of yeast at this point. My first batch I cultured with sourdough. The next I cultured with some raw sprouted corn paste that I put aside and did not cook. Both batches fermented vigorously and tasted great. If you get into a routine of doing this, you could save some of each batch of tesguino in a jar in the fridge to start the next batch. Litzinger writes that the tarahumara gauge the progress of fermentation just as I do by monitoring the rate of bubbling. The cycle begins by a slow bubbling stage, followed by a fast bubbling stage. The end of the fast bubbling marks the point when the beverage is consumed. Once the bubbling starts to slow, drink up and enjoy. I like to bottle it while it is still fermenting, in plastic so I can gauge pressure and avoid explosions, then drink or refrigerate as soon as a little pressure builds. There are some contemporary recipes for tesguino that call for fermenting a thin sweet porridge of masa flour with added sugar, piloncillo. Anthropologist Henry Brueman does not hide his disdain for this variation. The post-conquest vulgarization of the process is obvious. 500 years into the post-Columbian experiment in globalization, no practices or traditions are unchanged. Culture is dynamic, and cross-cultural influence is a fact. Methods of tesguino preparation vary among different ethnic groups, notes Steinkraus. Bennett and Zing report, "We drank tesguino wherever we went, and it showed a great difference in taste." Some groups consider various botanical additions to be important, while others do not. Practices with common roots often diverge over time, as each generation encounters different conditions and influences. For practices to remain relevant, they must be adapted. Tesguino is also made from the sap pressed from fresh green corn stalks. Probably this is the original corn ferment, from which all others are adaptations. Anthropologists have proposed that the use of corn as grain was preceded by the use of the stalks for fermentable juices. John Smalley and Michael Blake hypothesized that maize was domesticated not for food, but for drink, and that the earliest maize beverages came from the sweet stalks. Initially, early archaic peoples in Mexico experimented with zea by casually harvesting the sweet stalks and simply chewing them. Later, they recognized that they could produce large quantities of sweet juice by mashing and squeezing the stalks. They then fermented the juice, probably using techniques and technologies already available for other plants. Only as a result of its cultivation for this purpose did larger ears and kernels emerge, according to this theory. We can never really know origins, but regardless of their origins, our cultural legacies disappear without continued use and adaptation. Sorghum beer. Sorghum beer is the traditional beer of much of Africa. Homemade, it is fresh and appealing, with a complex, sweet, alcoholic, sour flavor. The process is fun and educational. Like tesguino, sorghum beer is a starchy suspension, sometimes referred to as opaque beer. Opaque beer is more a food than a beverage, states a report of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. It contains high proportions of starch and sugars, besides proteins, fats, vitamins, and minerals. Anthropologist Patrick McGovern reports that in the West African nation of Burkina Faso, sorghum beer accounts for half of the caloric intake. Sorghum beers are now being commercially produced in the United States and marketed as gluten-free beers. These are made with sorghum, but in the style of barley beers, hopped and clarified, not opaque. To most of the Western world, opaque sorghum beer would hardly be recognized or considered as such, writes homebrew guru Charlie Papazian. I feel quite certain that these beers were among the first beers ever brewed. Unlike the Mesopotamian and ancient Egyptian brews, these sorghum beers remain a living tradition, though no less historical. In reality, it has more tradition than any Pils, Bock, Pale Ale, or Stout. Like any ancient tradition that has diffused widely, sorghum beers are made in different regions following a bewildering variety of recipes under a confusing number of names. Sometimes millet, corn, maize, or other grains are used in addition to or instead of sorghum. This beer is essentially thin porridge fermented with malt, and it is prepared in at least as many varied ways as porridges are. Though the particulars can be somewhat quirky, the generic process is pretty straightforward. 1. Sprout sorghum. 2. Dry it in the sun. 3. Grind it. 4. Make a porridge of unfermented grain, add some ground malt for saccharification and souring. 5. Cook that in more water. And finally, 6. Add more raw malt as a starter and ferment. Grain sorghum is not commonly available in the United States, except in African groceries and from seed suppliers. Millet works great and may be easier to find. Sorghum sprouts just like any other seed. Soak seeds overnight, drain and keep moist, well ventilated, and protected from sunlight for 2 to 4 days, until tails emerge from the sprouts about 3/4 inch or 2 centimeters long. Traditionally, malt is dried in the sun, though dehydrators, fans, and other methods of low-heat drying can be used. After drying, the malted grain is stable for dry storage and is often aged for several months before use. Prior to brewing into beer, grind malted grain using a mill, mortar and pestle, or other means. In addition, grind roughly the same quantity of unmalted grain as you initially soaked for malting. To produce a variety of flavors and color in their beer, local village and home brewers may roast all or a portion of their grains and malts, notes Charlie Papazian. Sorghum beer is made in at least 2 distinct fermentations. The first is primarily a lactic acid fermentation. The second primarily a yeast fermentation. If not consumed quickly, a third acetic acid fermentation follows. From reading, I take it there is much regional and tribal variation in sorghum beer production. The method described here has worked well for me, but is certainly not the last word. This method is followed by another very different sorghum beer method for a Sudanese beer called Merissa. 1 pound or 500 grams of malted grain plus another pound or 500 grams unmalted grain yields about 1 gallon or 4 liters of sorghum beer. The volume ratio of malted grain to unmalted grain to water is 1 to 1 to 3. Boil water. Stir in unmalted sorghum grits/flour and continue stirring to achieve a porridge-like consistency. Remove from the heat and allow to cool. Once the porridge cools to 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 degrees Celsius, or without using a thermometer once it's cool enough to comfortably touch but still quite warm, add half the malted sorghum grit/flour, reserving half to add later. Stir malt into the porridge thoroughly. The enzymes in the raw malt can act at peak efficiency at this temperature, digesting complex carbohydrates in simple sugars. Leave in a warm or insulated spot, protected from flies. After a few hours, when the mash cools to below 110 degrees Fahrenheit or 43 degrees Celsius, add half of the remaining malt. Leave the other half for one more later addition and stir well to distribute. Leave in a warm spot for 12 to 24 hours, depending upon temperature, during which time lactic acid bacteria proliferate, lowering pH and thus creating an advantageous selective environment. The next step is to cook this soured mash in more water for several hours to caramelize sugars, adding water as necessary to maintain a gruel-like starch suspension. Cool to around body temperature, then add the final portion of raw ground malted sorghum. Introduced into this soured and brewed mixture, the raw malt introduces yeasts for the final alcohol fermentation. Or you could substitute a packet of yeast. Ferment in a warm spot protected from flies. In the tropics, fermentation time is measured in hours. In my temperate zone, I have typically fermented 2 or 3 days, then strained it through cheesecloth and bottled it in plastic soda bottles to ferment a few more hours to trap carbonation. Fresh sorghum beer is alive and pressurizes quickly, so always use caution not to overcarbonate. Like all indigenous fermented beverages, sorghum beer exists in a shifting socioeconomic context, deeply embedded in community practices. It emerged in the context of gift exchange reciprocity and continues to exist as such in many places. But it also spread via trade routes and developed early as a cottage industry. In southern Africa, cash brewing initially took the form of women providing sorghum beer to men who had migrated to urban areas to work, writes economist Stephen J. Hagblade in his doctoral dissertation on the shifting economic patterns reflected in sorghum beer in Botswana. According to an International Labor Office report from 1972, brewing on a domestic scale may well be the greatest single source of employment, particularly for single women, in some African countries. The Botswana government reported in the 1970s that brewing is the most widespread manufacturing activity in rural Botswana and is the most important source of female employment in the rural economy. In Botswana and elsewhere in southern Africa, the women who make and sell sorghum beer are called shebeen queens, their shops, typically their homes, shebeens. The first sorghum beer factories appeared in the region in the early 1900s. Hagblade reports that in Botswana, sorghum beer brewing was the first modern manufacturing industry. In the late 1930s, the South African government banned the sale of homebrew in urban areas and required municipal governments to supply sorghum beer. After that, explains Hagblade, commercial brewing really took off. Today, the most popular brand of sorghum beer in southern Africa is Chibuku, sold in waxed cartons, how milk is sold. The beer is also known as Shake Shake, because of its propensity to settle into its liquid and solid fractions, reports the BBC. Shaking restores the beverage to its former grainy off-yogurt consistency, with a zesty effervescence not unlike Lambrusco. Industrial brews have captured ever-growing market shares, but with economic repercussions. Employment, incomes, and overall economic profit are all decreasing as a result of the rising importance of factory brewing, writes Hagblade, leading to a large redistribution of income from poor and medium-income groups to the rich. That is part of the story everywhere, as the mass producers of food concentrate wealth, erase cultural difference, render vital cultural knowledge and skills obsolete, breed dependency, and decontextualize our food. Marisa, Sudanese toasted sorghum beer. One place where ancient beer traditions have endured, despite their official religious prohibition, is the Sudan, where sorghum beer is known mostly as Marisa. Marisa is one of the indelible features of the African heritage that resisted Islamic teachings, imposing itself prominently on the intricacies of the Sudanese way of life, wrote Hamid Dirar in 1993. Its production and consumption in the Sudan is common to pagans, Christians, and Muslims alike. Marisa is far from a standardized product. The Sudan is a treasury of sorghum beers, according to Dirar. It is impossible to enumerate all the kinds of beer found in the country. These beers differ in ingredients and in the preparation procedures. Yet, because of the rule of Islamic law since the 1980s, Dirar reports that the sale of Marisa and its public consumption are illicit. I tried emailing Dr. Dirar to confirm that Marisa production is still widespread, but I was unable to reach him. Then I had the good fortune to meet Crazy Crow, a young Sudanese man now living in the United States, who reports that in Sudan, despite 2 decades of legal prohibition, with the threat of 40 lashes for violating that prohibition, the Marisa-making tradition has persevered. In honor of South Sudan's birth as an independent, sovereign nation on July 9, 2011, freeing it from the constraints of Islamic law, I made a batch of Marisa, guided by the incredibly detailed documentation of the process contained in Dirar's excellent book, The Indigenous Fermented Foods of the Sudan. Marisa is simple in that the only ingredients are sorghum and water, yet these 2 ingredients are manipulated in many different ways. As with the sorghum beer, 2 pounds or 1 kilogram of sorghum will make about 1 gallon or 4 liters of beer. Malting. Marissa requires only a small bit of malted sorghum, roughly 5 to 10% by either weight or volume, of the total sorghum used in the beer. As in the sorghum beer described above, soak the grains overnight, drain, and keep moist, well ventilated, and protected from sunlight for 2 to 4 days, until tails emerge from the sprouts about 3/4 inch or 2 centimeters long. After sprouting, dry the malt in the sun, or using a dehydrator, fan, or other method of low heat drying. The dried malted sorghum is stable for dry storage and is often aged for several months before use. To the small amount of malt, add 10 to 20 times as much unmalted grain. The rest of the process takes no more than 48 hours in Sudan, but a bit longer in more moderate climates. Ajin fermentation. Ajin is the sourdough at the heart of Sudanese sorghum culture. To make ajin, coarsely grind unmalted sorghum for the beer and divide it into 3 equal quantities, each of which will be processed separately. Take note of the volume of each of the 3, as additions of water will be based upon that unit. 1 unit of the ground flour will be fermented into ajin. Place the ground sorghum in a non-metallic bowl or jar and dampen with minimal water. Add dechlorinated water, just a bit at a time, to the flour, then mix. And add a little more water until there are no more dry patches in the flour. When I did this, it took about 50% as much water as flour I was dampening by volume. Cover with a cloth. Durar recommends fermenting this for 36 hours in the Sudan heat. I let mine go, stirring and smelling each day, for about 3 days, when it began to have a discernible sour aroma. Sarij dry roasting. Sarij is dry roasted ajin. This is the step that gives Marissa its characteristic flavor and color. Heat a cast iron or other heavy skillet over medium heat. Add ajin and continuously flip, stir, and toss it in the pan to dry and toast evenly and prevent burning. Use a spatula or other tool with a hard edge that can get under the roasting sorghum meal. Turn it over so no surface stays in prolonged contact with the heat. Be sure to get into the corners of the pan. Break up clumps to facilitate drying. Feel the sorghum getting drier and notice it darkening as it roasts. As water evaporates, the color of the fumes changes from the hue of steam to that of smoke, observes Dirar. This is a sign that the sarij is done. Charring of the sarij is an integral part of the process. It should just be beginning to char, not fully carbonized. Like many roasted foods, the sorghum is enhanced by the slightly burned edge, but could be ruined by outright burning. Sarij can be stored dry or used right away. It seems that a major aim behind the harsh heat treatment given to sarij is the destruction of acid-forming bacteria, so only a very few of them gain access to the forthcoming yeast fermentation, explains Dirar. The major function of ajin fermentation is to provide the lactic acid necessary for lowering the pH to a level conducive to yeast growth and to provide the slight sour flavor which is generally appreciated by Sudanese in many foods and beverages. However, production of too much lactic acid, and, even worse, the production of acetic acid above certain limits, are detrimental to the flavor of Marissa. Hence the importance of the sterilization of ajin, which carries the microorganisms productive of these acids, to give sarij. Diboba fermentation. The next stage of the Marissa making process is to moisten the sarij using a little water and a little mature Marissa. Since I had no mother Marissa, I made and used a batch of the more generic sorghum beer recipe, which uses no starter beyond the raw malt. You could try it with just raw malt as a starter, or add yeast, or another actively fermenting beer. Whatever starter you use, add it and the water only a very little at a time, and stir well. Add only as much liquid as the sarij can absorb. The aim is to make the sarij soggy, not submerge it. When I tasted the soggy sarij, it reminded me of the breakfast cereal, grape nuts. Leave it to sit and ferment a few hours, 4 to 5 hours in Sudan, a few hours longer in a moderate temperature. After this initial, slightly soggy fermentation, mix in ground sorghum malt. Dirar's directions call for 5% malt, based on the unit of sorghum flour you started with for the ajin. I used twice that amount because I observed low germination of the sorghum during malting. Mix the sorghum malt into the soggy sarij by hand. Then add water 3 times the volume of the sorghum meal unit. In other words, roughly equal to the total volume of unmalted sorghum used in the Marisa. Once this water is added, active bubbly fermentation begins quickly. Routinely, the brewer would follow the action of the malt on cerise by tasting the mash, now and then, to see if it has turned sweet enough, adding more malt as required. The resulting deboba is a non-inviting, dark, thick sludge with a bitter taste, explains Durar. Marisa fermentation. The deboba ferments about 7 hours like that before the next addition. At least an hour or two before that time has passed, the flour must be prepared to add to the brew. Each of the 2/3 is cooked in a slightly different way. They are both cooked with water into porridge, acida, but one is fully cooked while the other is only half cooked. Then both acidas are cooled and mixed together into a dough called futara. Durar theorizes that perhaps the combining of fully cooked and undercooked porridges gives an optimal ratio of ungelatinized to gelatinized starches, though he reports that local brewers explain the function of half-cooked futara as providing the required gritty feel on the palate of the consumer. Start with the fully cooked porridge, as it takes longer to cool. To make porridge, fill a pot with fresh cold water, about triple the volume of the flour unit. Sprinkle a handful of flour on the surface of the cold water as it heats. Once the water comes to a boil, add the rest of the flour and stir vigorously. Break up clumps of flour and continually scrape the bottom of the pan so it does not begin to burn. As sorghum cooks, it absorbs all the water and thickens. Keep stirring. To test for doneness, press a wet finger briefly into the acida. Your finger should come away clean and the porridge should bounce back. If necessary, cook further, stirring continuously, and test again after a few minutes. When acida passes the test, it is spread out to cool. I pour it onto a cookie sheet, and it holds a cohesive, perfectly rounded form as it cools. As the fully cooked acida cools, start heating water for the half-cooked porridge. Start with less water, just equal to the volume of the flour unit. As above, sprinkle a handful of flour on the surface of the cold water while it heats. Once the water comes to a boil, add the rest of the flour and stir, breaking up clumps of flour and continually scraping the bottom of the pan so it does not begin to burn. In this case, stir until the porridge thickens, then cut off the heat, add another equal volume of cold water, and keep stirring until it reaches a homogeneous texture. Spread the half-cooked acida to cool on a cookie sheet or in a big bowl. Once both the fully and half-cooked acidas are cool enough to comfortably handle, the two are worked into each other by hand to give futara. Then knead the malt into the futara, roughly 5 to 10% malt based on the 2 units of flour now joined together. Transfer the resulting mass to the already fermenting deboba, left as a solid mass overwhelmed by the thick deboba slurry. Do not even stir, so the mass of futara slowly dissolves. This slows fermentation, desirable in the summer heat. In the winter months, when faster fermentation is desired, futara is actively stirred into the deboba. Finally, all the different sorghum and water combinations are fermenting together, but just for a short time. Durar writes that the typical Marisa fermentation time in the Sudan is about 7 hours. Then it is strained and drinking begins. As the day wears on, Marisa develops a sharp, acid flavor, and by the evening it would have spoiled. In Tennessee's July heat, however, no step of the Marisa process was quite as fast as Durar describes. I strained some of my Marisa after about 7 hours, and then some 24 hours later. The 24-hour later batch was much stronger, without becoming excessively acidic at all. To strain, place a colander over a bowl and line the colander with a large, finely woven cotton cloth. Fill with Marisa. Carefully gather together the corners and edges of the cloth and use them to lift the Marisa in the cloth out of the colander. Twist the contents enclosed in the cloth to force liquid through the cloth. Press it against the colander. Keep squeezing and pressing to force liquid out. As the contents of the cloth become smaller and denser, wrap it more tightly and keep pressing. Press until it feels like there is no more liquid left. Marisa can be stored a few days in a full bottle in the refrigerator, but like most indigenous beers, this is a gift to share and enjoy, not hold on to. As Marisa sits in the fridge, the starch settles at the bottom of the bottle, leaving a clear, dark beer, not unlike a chocolate stout or other very dark beer, that can be carefully poured off and enjoyed. Delicious. Durar describes 2 grades of Marisa. Daga is pressed from about a quarter of the fermenting liquid. The rest of the brew, comprising the bulk of Marissa, is first diluted with an equal volume of water and then strained. The resultant weaker Marissa is called mahage, which is the usual form in which Marissa is sold. I pressed all of my Marissa into Daga, then covered the residue with a little more water, which yielded a very weak product. The solid residue from Marissa, mushuk, is fed to animals, a highly valued, fattening feed. I highly recommend Marissa as a delicious and unusual beer-making experience. Its rich, layered flavor reflects the complexity of its preparation. May the culture of Marissa once again flourish in the newly independent nation of South Sudan. Asian rice brews. Japanese sake is the rice-based alcohol that is best known in the West. Sake is distinctive in certain ways, but is also part of a much broader group of beverages produced throughout Asia using mold enzymes to saccharify rice and other grains. The next chapter covers the molds themselves, as well as concepts and simple methods for growing some of them. The discussion here, concerning basic techniques for fermenting grain-based alcoholic beverages using molds, presumes that you obtain mold cultures commercially or through gift exchange, or make them as described in the following chapter. I've had great results fermenting with Chinese chu, sold as yeast in the form of small balls about 1 inch or 2.5 centimeters in diameter, available in many Asian groceries and on the internet. Similar mixed culture starters, incorporating a variety of molds as well as yeasts and bacteria, are in use throughout Asia and go by many different names, including ragi, Indonesia and Malaysia, marcha, India and Nepal, Nuruk, Korea, Bubot, Philippines, Lu Pang, Thailand, and many others. Japanese koji is derived from the same tradition, but in contemporary practice it is typically an isolated single mold, Aspergillus oryzae, cultured in the exclusion of yeast and bacteria. Alcoholic beverages made from rice in these different places are produced by processes that vary in many details, but as a group they all share certain methods that distinguish them from beers made in the Western tradition. First of all, saccharification, the breakdown of complex carbohydrates into fermentable simple sugars, occurs simultaneously with the fermentation of those sugars into alcohol. In the Western tradition, saccharification, by way of malting and then holding the mash at high but controlled temperatures to optimize enzyme activity, always takes place prior to alcohol fermentation. Another distinguishing characteristic of these Asian grain ferments, which they share with sorghum beer, desguino, and most indigenous brews, is that the cooked grain itself is always fermented, rather than just a liquid extraction, as with contemporary Western malted grain beers, in which only the clear liquid wort extracted from the grain mash is fermented. As the rice saccharifies and ferments, it also liquefies. In ancient China, the liquid was extracted to drink via straws. Actually, the practice of drinking beers with filtered straws is a worldwide phenomenon, according to Patrick McGovern, used not only in ancient China but also the Fertile Crescent, the Pacific Islands, the Americas, and Africa, and still widely practiced. Nepali millet tungba, described in this chapter, is typically drunk through a straw.